Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll explore a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look at how an old-fashioned political speech seems to have turned around President Obama's political momentum and perhaps reversed the fortunes of his healthcare reform effort. We'll speak with Ron Suskin, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. Suskin is the author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. His latest book is The Way of the World, a reflection on the legacy of the Bush-Cheney regime that led to wars and self-inflicted strategic damage, as well as financial ruin and widespread impoverishment. Then we'll assess the possibility of unlimited corporate money flooding into the political campaigns and overwhelming the electoral system. We'll be joined by Scott Nelson, who's a senior attorney for the litigation group at Public Citizen. Nelson's an expert in campaign finance law, and this week he argued before the U.S. Supreme Court. He was a clerk to the Honorable Byron White, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, and he recently co-authored an amicus brief in the critical case that could lead to a corporate takeover of campaign finance now before the Supreme Court. And then we'll address the phenomenon of idiot America, where ignorance, anti-intellectualism, and disrespect is dominating political discourse. We'll be joined by Charles Pierce, who's a journalist, commentator, and author. He has been a writer-at-large for Esquire since 1997 and is a frequent contributor to the American Prospect and Slate. His works also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Magazine, The Nation, The Atlantic, and the Chicago Tribune. His new book is Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. I'm now joined by Ron Suskind, and as I mentioned, Ron's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author, and he's written a number of books about the Bush administration, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, the White House, and the Education of Paul O'Neill, and the 1% Doctrine. And his latest book is The Way of the World. And just as President Obama, Ron Suskin, doesn't seem to have gotten much more mileage out of the fact that George Bush handed him such an economic disaster and a couple of essentially unwinnable wars. And it seems that the honeymoon's over now. Obama owns the economy and he owns the Iraq and Afghan wars.
Well, you know, George Bush would say it's ownership America, Ian. and the president now truly and fully owns everything on his ledger. The fact is we know that the global news cycles with their 24/7 frenetic madness have a very short attention span and frankly memory. And I think what's interesting in the debate over health care and the great wide array of domestic policies that have lined the shoreline here from the Obama administration, financial reform, health care, of course, energy policy, education policy, really industrial policy when it comes to automakers, that the president, is really at the center of every one of the lines of success or failure here. So people are extremely attentive to his every move, and I think there was a sense of his absence this summer as everybody went off the grid and screamed and yelled and threw up their hands, and that's why this speech last week was really quite a signature event.
Well, for example, Frank Rich in the New York Times is complaining about Obama, and there's been an awful lot of hand-wringing and angst from the progressive community for some time out here in Los Angeles. So many of my friends have been whining and wailing and saying, I've been betrayed, it's all over, and all this stuff, and he's failed, all of which I think just helps people like Jim DeMint. But nevertheless, in the New York Times, Frank Rich does make a point, though, that he's convinced that most Americans, just quoting, know more about the public option, what it really means, and they don't know anything, and in fact, the vacuum's been filled by these ridiculous death panels, etc. So they don't know anything about the public option, but they know a lot about these fictitious death panels.
Well, I can say that I think Obama might have defined the public option with a little more clarity, even in the big speech. You know, it's a very tricky kind of play here, because certainly Obama can't be in there every day in the 24/7 circus. He just simply can't. And the fact is, if he is answering a certain brand of critic, that, you know, they'll just keep yelling, you know, that, you know, the sun rises in the west and the west and the west over and over again. Even if Obama says it was east this morning, yesterday, today, and tomorrow, it won't matter. And so I think it is a kind of a strategy, which it makes some sense that he has to pick his spot, stay above it. You know, if you're in it, you're of it. And Obama, I think in this case, you know, I think there's probably some ennui inside of the White House. Well, maybe we waited too long. But I think the sense is that he needed to step up, and at that moment he needed to make it work. And I think he did that on Wednesday. I think the question now is, how do you capitalize on that? You think back to the great speeches the presidents have made in the past. You know, how would the 24/7 tendentious news cycles treat? You know, we have nothing to fear but fear itself from Roosevelt, or much less an address by Lincoln at the cemetery at Gettysburg. So I think now the challenge for Obama is to capitalize on what he has articulated. There is unity, for the most part, on the Democratic side now. I mean, they were in the White House yesterday, 17 senators, you know, and there was a real high five. What do we do now, Mr. President, kind of attitude, what I understand. So I think the next week or two will be really crucial for Obama to really move this ball forward in terms of actual policy. I think deep down, the summer, I think, proved to Americans that there's a lot of sound and fury that signifies absolutely nothing in American political discourse in this era. The time when the president stands up is the time where things will start, if they ever start. And I think now Obama needs to show he can close this. And I think that probably means keeping the Democratic camp in lockstep and keeping pressure on certain key Republicans who, after the speech, if you saw some of them on Fox News or whatnot, were a little befuddled.
But Ron Suskin, does it surprise you, though, that an old-fashioned speech could still have this kind of an effect in politics? I mean, one would have thought in the modern 24-hour news cycle age that it wouldn't work anymore. I mean, I'm sort of gratified, but what's your reaction to it?
I think many people are heartened by the fact that a presidential speech in front of a joint session is a special event. And in some ways, Obama, like presidents before him, are trying to figure out a way to manage public dialogue, to get some results, some distillate from it, with the office of the presidency as it now stands in this very, very noisy, bubble-up-from-the-bottom media age. And I think that I think a lot of people were sort of saying, my goodness, there's some old-fashioned veer, too. The president stood above the fray. He was often rather political in the speech, poking at enemies. But at the same time, I thought it was fascinating to watch the interplay of Joe Wilson, which in a way sets up the end of the speech that Obama obviously had already planned, written. Actually, people should have read it, Joe Wilson among them, where he said, that's one Republican Party, Joe Wilson screaming from the chamber, I am hoping to be part of in a conversation with a different party, the one that Ted Kennedy negotiated with, Orrin Hatch, John McCain, Chuck Grassley. It was an extraordinary sort of a rendering of the conflict in terms of the opposition, the two faces of the Republican Party, old but very much new, and the latter very angry. And not really, I don't think, drawing the kind of support deep down in the American populace that their noise seems to indicate.
Well, I'm not sure, though, Ron Suskind, by evoking Ted Kennedy, he certainly did point out, as you mentioned, how much he'd been bipartisan and been close to Orrin Hatch and Grassley. But, of course, when Grassley recently went back to Iowa and was ambushed by these town hall teabaggers, he then reversed himself and started to repeat all of these lies about pulling the plug on grandma. So, and yesterday in Washington, there was this another one of these teabag demonstrations largely generated by Glenn Beck, where there were signs up saying, bury Obamacare with Kennedy. Now, who's going to win this? In other words, if the people in the Senate prize themselves and take pride in the collegial atmosphere and the decorum, when they go back home and get screamed at, how much are they going to stand up for the decorum?
Well, this is the great drama in American public life as it stands. We have not had some of the characters at peaks of this mountain range, of this landscape that we have now. And I guess the question is one of character, one of defining the notion of public service for many of the folks in the Republican Party, certainly. Who is it that I represent? Where is the greatest good for the greatest number, which is certainly what government is supposed to keep its eye on, and how do I help us get closer to that? I think what Obama was trying to do was make it a choice, is to call them out and say, I know both sides of this equation, and I know the forces that are buffeting each of you. And I think that that in some ways that was all he could do. It's interesting because, right now, of course, you're seeing the counterpoint where folks like the rally yesterday down here is saying, we are making you Republican office holders choose as well. Let's see who has the greater force, because that really is what it comes down to. It's simply lots of airtime, something that is tantamount and an equivalent to actual force in the political dialogue or not. That's the question mark and the test that everybody right now is looking for an answer to.
And Ron Suskin, there's clearly a disconnect between the extent to which the Congress is polarized because of gerrymandering, where you have ideologues on the left and on the right dominating Congress. And the theory, and I think it's largely true, is that most Americans are in the center. So are you suggesting then that these noisy people on the right that are showing up, and by the way, I'm surprised that they're filling a political vacuum that the left, the left has all the right populist arguments on their side. It was, after all, the Bush administration who ruined the economy and brought us to the brink of financial collapse. And somehow these right-wing populists are angry at Wall Street for all the wrong reasons, because there's an information vacuum on the other side.
Yeah, there's no doubt that when it comes to tactical clarity, that the right has been writing the playbooks actually for quite some time now. And, what's the old joke? I think it was Bob Dole or one of those fellows who said it. He said a liberal is a guy who takes the other side in an argument. there's something about progressive or liberal discourse and the attempt to say, okay, well, here's my side. I understand yours, but my side is right and the evidence shows as such, which does not work nearly so well in the loudest and noisiest winds political discourse of this era. But I think the question becomes, is that sound and fury, as I say, that signifies less than people might seem to think as it unfolds? And I think when you look at the underlying poll data, as you sort of suggest, is that most people are with most of the policies that the Obama administration is pushing forward, and certainly with them on balance when it comes to the goals of health care. People want to change, and they want to change more or less along the lines of the blended approach that Obama has now embraced and has publicly stated. At day's end, I think that will be the gravamen of victory. But the fact is that the fight really now is, if anything, ratcheting up now that the mark is clear, the target, if you will, of what the Obama administration is embracing, has championed. So, fire away.
Well, it remains to be seen. Last week I interviewed Nate Silver, who's made a prediction that the Democrats could lose, that they could even lose the House, not the Senate. Although he's got a pretty big spread, from they could lose 12 seats to 50, but if you're saying, I think Ron Suskin, that the center is out there and we're only hearing from the far right, who are noisy and who are attracting the cameras, and so it remains to be seen. What's your prediction in terms, particularly in terms of what Nate Silver is saying?
I don't think that position is right. I know Newt Gingrich and others have talked about it, and Karl Rove has been out with kind of his playbook all through the summer, saying here's what it looks like based on various historical precedents. I think his are misapplied, frankly, for these midterm elections in 2010 to help steal the discipline and resolve of Republicans who oppose the president no matter what he said. I think that's literal fallacy, if you will. I think it's impossible to predict the midterm. It's a long time away, and the fact is that this game is fully in play right now. Hmm. You know, the bottom line is that even though people are turning on Fox News or MSNBC for that matter, most of them are being guided at this point by kitchen table economics, by saying, what is it like in my life, my family? What does my future look like? And they want remedies. They don't want somebody to say, everything's busted, everything's wrong, and so I'll do nothing. They want an answer. And the question is, can the Obama administration offer a credible solution to not everything that people say might be tended to, but at least enough to show the capacity of government to solve problems for the greatest good on balance? Hmm. And I think that's the great question, and it goes down to an even deeper issue. Of this sort of ethereal thing called confidence that everyone talks about, from the public policy schools to the economists to the folks in the House and the Senate to folks who live their lives day to day in the wide span of America. Do I have confidence that tomorrow is going to be somehow at least modestly improved or at least reasonably enough up ahead improved that I can make certain decisions that are in my long-term best interest, rather move based on a kind of panic of the instant? And I think that's a huge, huge imponderable, because you can have overconfidence, and you can also have, as Larry Summers has said, the president's chief economic advisor, over-pessimism. Mm-hmm. And that over-pessimism can have rather profound, disastrous effects for an economy structured as our economy is at this point. And so, in a way, Obama, he's seeing stormy seas ahead, but certainly this week was a big week for him because that speech, the guy's got terrific chops. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. To get up there and summon political rhetoric, the chosen and perfect word with such force, I think left a lot of people, with a sense of shock and awe, and some people were quite stunned. And now we'll see how they recover in the next week or two or three. The question is, can the administration, and they're moving now, can they move quickly to capitalize on some of that before it starts to dissipate in noisy America?
Well, I thank you for joining us, Ron Saskin. Obviously, the president, and particularly the Democrats, are entering in next year. They're entering a landscape with, 9.7% unemployment. Another figure is 16.8% if you include those people who've given up and the part-time workers. And then I suppose in closing, what's happening with Joe Wilson in South Carolina is sort of the canary in the mine in this discussion. Wilson's apparently in behaving so badly has nevertheless been rewarded by $750,000, but his Democratic opponent, who almost beat him last time, has been rewarded by $1 million. There you have it.
You'll have plenty more listeners, Ian, going forward, because this next circus is just getting underway.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Ron Saskin.
Be well. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Ron Saskin, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist. He's covered the George Bush era with a number of books, The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush and the White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. And his latest book is The Way of the World. I'm now speaking with Scott Nelson, who's a senior attorney for the litigation group at Public Citizen. Scott is an expert on campaign finance law, and he was also a clerk to the Honorable Byron White, Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And he recently co-authored an amicus brief in the critical case that could lead to a corporate takeover of campaign finance. This is a case before the Supreme Court this week. What was your sense, Scott Nelson, of I know that it's the justices are pretty inscrutable, but I understand that the conservative group, the four, Scalia, Thomas, Roberts and Alito, gave the Solicitor General for the Obama administration, Mr. Kagan, a pretty tough time, and they were pretty skeptical. So how do you read the tea leaves from that?
Well, to begin with, I like to try not to make predictions about cases from oral argument, especially cases that I'm involved in. But, you know, we knew going into this case that Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy actually had already essentially said where they stand on this issue, which is that they would like to see the court's major rulings permitting regulation of corporate campaign speech rolled back. So, we have a pretty clear sense from the way they voted in prior cases that Justices Ginsburg, Breyer, and Stevens would likely uphold the current law. So it, you know, it comes down to three justices who you know really haven't committed themselves on this issue in the past: Roberts and Alito, and the newest justice Sotomayor. And I think it's fair to say that Justices Roberts and Alito, you know, gave the Solicitor General a pretty thorough grilling. On the other hand, Justice Roberts asked some tough questions of the other side as well. But you know, we would have preferred not to be in the position of having this case argued on this issue at all. So you know, the mere fact that we were there was not good news. And you know, the justices' questions, I think, make pretty clear that you know, they see this in particular. The more conservative members of the court see this as a very serious question, whether they're going to uphold the existing statutes.
But isn't there a danger here where you had this with the D.C. gun ban case that was that essentially reinterpreted the Second Amendment, that the people that argued against that ruling were arguing to keep the ruling narrow? And you were arguing that this week, weren't you, your side?
I mean,
you're saying, you know, keep it narrow, but it looks like the conservatives want to open it up and make a statement.
Well, and we know again that's the position that three of them have taken, and you know, they had the opportunity when this case was argued before in the spring to resolve it on some narrow basis, and they felt that they wanted to open up these broader questions. So, you know, we're arguing that they should step back from that brink. And, you know, there are powerful arguments why they should. The way the court normally decides issues of constitutional and statutory law is not to reach out for the biggest question first. But then again, sometimes the court gets a majority to go a certain way and they rule more broadly. So that's, you know, that's what's sort of hanging in the balance in this case.
And specifically, the case hinges on a movie called Hillary the Movie, right? And it essentially was blocked under the McCain-Feingold because it was clearly political. And you know that in campaigns they've been pushing up to that limit where advocacy groups pretend to be only interested in broader issues, but they're clearly – there's a partisan subtext, right?
Yes, and I mean, the question that you ask raises a lot of issues that go to the case. One thing is that it isn't the movie itself that anyone was trying to restrict here. It was only broadcasting it over cable, or in this case, satellite systems, you know, anybody really is free to make a movie and show it in a theater as a commercial enterprise. But what was being done here was, you know, this movie was going to be put out on cable as, in effect, an extended kind of 90-minute
infomercial.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, against Hillary Clinton, and it was done using money that came from business corporations, really intentionally as a test case. You know, the organization deliberately chose to use some corporate dollars to fund the movie, and then, you know, immediately went to court. I think they initially had the idea of making it a somewhat more limited test case, but it turned out, you know, now it's a test case for the very concept that any corporation, you know, up to and including ExxonMobil or Microsoft or GM, can be restricted in the way that it participates in electoral politics.
So this is a phenomenon where conservative activists are in effect Supreme Court shopping. Didn't it happen with the Second Amendment case as well?
Yes, you know, I mean, when you have a court that you think is favorable, you know, people tend to try to create cases that will get up there and make law that they like, and you know, that's clearly going on in a variety of areas with the conservative court that we have.
So, during the confirmations of Roberts and Alito, and you could go back further, of course, to Scalia and Thomas, but just in the more recent ones, there were all, you know, the ubiquitous argument of abortion seems to dominate the discourse, but nobody seems to ever want to talk about the extent to which these justices are also beholden to big business, or, you know, to put it bluntly, that they're corporatists. That we never seem to get into that analysis, do we?
No, and I think that speaks to the pervasiveness and the acceptance of the notion that we've become a society where you know, people have taken to heart what was said by GM's chairman in the 1950s, you know, what's good for corporations is good for the country is the sort of dominant view, and the fact that you know, pretty much anyone who is in our court system probably at some point in their career had a background of working in a big law firm representing corporations. You know, has just come to be viewed as the norm, and it's unusual if like, for example, Justice Ginsburg, you didn't have that experience.
So it seems, though, as Scott Nelson, in this case, that the predictions of the consequences of neutering McCain-Feingold and allowing unlimited corporate money into the political process, I think the consequences are pretty clear, and that's the part that I find extraordinary about it. It will change the entire nature of politics. It's bad enough now, particularly out here in California, where you have this initiative process where they're mendacious and deceptive, and you never know what you're voting for, and money pours in from the various special interests in on one side and the other, and it's full of traps and tricks. It's a dismal prospect.
Well, one of the things about this case also is that it's being decided in the absence of any kind of record of you know, the facts as to what can be expected. And you know, the other side has.
You mean you can't even argue this that when you were before the Supreme Court? You can't argue the consequences?
What we've argued is that there will be consequences, and their extent is unknown and unknowable because this case, you know, in the lower court was argued on very different and much narrower grounds, so nobody got to make a presentation about, for example, the experience in California. And the other side says in their briefs, well, you know, there are a number of states that don't limit corporate spending in elections, such as California, and, you know, everything's just fine there. And the fact of the matter is, you know, the court doesn't know one way or another what the facts are because they were never developed in this case. So, you know, the experience of California, I think, is very likely to be repeated on a much broader scale if this gets opened up nationwide. And you'll see, I think, the National Chamber of Commerce acting as kind of the repository of corporate cash and intervening in elections where they think that an infusion of money can make a difference where there's a candidate that they either want to target or want to protect.
Well, it sort of reminds me a little, and I may be a little off the wall, Scott Nelson, but this whole situation in terms of the consequences reminds me of what happened with the Fairness Doctrine. You know, the Fairness Doctrine was brought in the 30s, I believe, under Roosevelt because of people like Father Coughlin, who was a fascist and an anti-Semite, who was dominating the airwaves, and Colonel McCormick and other plutocrats who owned the media and used the media as their own personal political soapbox. And Roosevelt brought in this ruling, which essentially quietened down political speech because it said, you know, if you're a media owner, you can go ahead and proselytize, but you have to offer equal time to the other side's argument. And that had the effect of dampening it down. And then under Reagan, they took it away. And a lot of people knew that it would have the consequences of Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh taking over the airwaves.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the notion there is, well, we're now in a new world where there are so many media outlets that everybody has some place where they can find a voice, but it doesn't appear that that's necessarily the case.
Well, then, how do people like the famous First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams argue on behalf of unlimited corporate money? I know he's arguing in terms of the First Amendment. And I guess in many ways the entire issue of campaign finance is circumscribed by Buckley v. Vallejo. So can you just explain for the audience how the constitutional the framework of this?
Yeah, it makes distinctions that probably only lawyers would think of, but as you say, you mentioned the case of Buckley v. Vallejo, which was decided in the 1970s after our first kind of effort at major campaign reform in the wake of Watergate, where Congress enacted a statute that limited both contributions to campaigns and also it limited the ability of people to make direct expenditures in support of campaigns, even individuals, so that it would say, you know, an individual can only give $1,000 to a campaign and an individual can also only make an expenditure of $1,000 in support of a candidate. And there what the court said, well, is that, you know, contributions, they have some First Amendment protection, but they're not directly speech. When you give money to a candidate, you're really making an association between yourself and the candidate's campaign, but you yourself are not directly speaking. And also the potential for corruption with large amounts of money going directly to candidates is sufficient to justify putting limits on contributions. But the court at the same time said, but when you actually spend money independently, for example, if you buy time for an ad, they said that we're going to consider to be just plain speech. That's just like, you know, holding up a sign that says, you know, vote for Smith, or like saying to your neighbor, I think you should vote for Smith. And the court said we won't allow that to be regulated in the case of individuals. Later decisions distinguished, however, between individuals and corporations for purposes of limiting expenditures, saying that there was a difference created by the potential for corporate mobilization of what they call vast war chests that would have a distorting impact on our political landscape and would create the impression among voters that, you know, everything is a matter of being bought and paid for by corporations. So the court drew a distinction first between contributions and expenditures and then between corporations and individuals. And what Floyd Abrams and others on that side of the debate say is they take the part of that that they like, the part that says expenditures are speech, and then they say, well, corporations have the same free speech rights as individuals, and if individuals can spend money to support candidates that they like, a corporation must have the same First Amendment right, and anything that would limit the ability of corporations to mobilize their dollars is the equivalent of censorship.
I believe the ACLU has also supported that at one time or another, didn't they?
Yeah, the ACLU kind of has an interesting position because they have argued that side, but a lot of there's also a group of, I think, former ACLU board members who very strongly disagreed with them and have written briefs supporting the other side. So there's kind of a division in the world of people associated with the ACLU, although the organization's position is really at this point in support of the Floyd Abrams, Ted Olson corporate speech side of this debate,
which is a bit mind-boggling when you consider that liberals feel that corporations have the unlimited rights as persons in law. I mean, obviously, that ruling, what, in the 1890s, Santa Clara versus Southern Pacific, has made corporations persons in law, but there's no actual person there, you know?
I mean, right. And
it's
and
a rubric, isn't it?
The way that the existing campaign law works is it lets the real people who are associated with corporations, the shareholders, the officers, the directors, they can contribute their own personal funds to corporate PACs, and the corporations can speak in that way. But there, you know that it's that any dollars that are spent are being spent on behalf of real people who have designated their money for political uses, and they're subject to the same limits that you and I have to face if we want to give to a political organization. It really is the notion that the corporation, this impersonal entity, has the same right to participate as a speaker in our elections as you and I. That's the position on the other side.
And they've got all the money and power in the world, and the individual is just tilting at this vast corporate windmill.
Right. It's the old notion that the rich and poor have the same right to sleep under the bridges of Paris. You know, although a little bit in reverse, I guess. In this case, I have the same right as ExxonMobil to spend $10 million on campaign ads if the other side prevails. Well, you know, that does ExxonMobil a lot more good than it does me.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. I hope that you and your colleagues, are able to prevail in this Supreme Court case, because the consequences, I think, are extraordinary, and they will change the entire political landscape by any reasonable prediction. So it's just surreal that this is happening, and there doesn't seem to be the sufficient alarm in the population to get the message to those guys on the bench that they could change the entire nature of American politics.
Yeah, and we've been trying to get out the word that this is a really important and fundamental issue, and the fact of the matter is that most people aren't necessarily oriented towards thinking about the abstract and confusing legal questions that the Supreme Court addresses, but this is one that really will have a big impact on our democracy.
I thank you very much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Scott Nelson.
Thank you.
Again, Scott Nelson, senior attorney with the litigation group at Public Citizen, and he wrote an amicus brief in the critical case that could lead to a corporate takeover campaign finance, the case now before the Supreme Court. And I'm now speaking with Charles Pierce, who's a journalist, commentator, and author. He's been a writer at large for Esquire since 1997 and is a frequent contributor to the American Prospect and Slate. His work has also appeared in the New York Times Magazine, the Los Angeles Times Magazine, The Nation, The Atlantic, and the Chicago Tribune. And his new book is Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. And we've seen this phenomenon, Charles Pierce, just over this weekend in Washington, D.C., with this Glenn Beck-generated teabag demonstration, where ignorance, anti-intellectualism, and disrespect is now dominating our political discourse. There were signs up, for example, saying, bury Obamacare with Kennedy. I mean, I imagine you're as shocked as most people are by the deterioration of the discourse, and you've got this Congressman Joe Wilson reflecting that disrespect. Is this, do you think, an inexorable trend in our polity?
Well, I am enormously distressed, and as I think, Ian, when we talked before, I pointed out that I don't think the people in Washington with their crazy signs and crazy ideas and very bizarre simulacrum of political history are the citizens of Idiot America. I think the citizens of Idiot America are the rest of us, and I am frankly amazed that people who consistently refer to themselves as conservative intellectuals and people who consistently refer to themselves as serious members of the national discourse and members of the Republican Party haven't run away and hid from these people. I saw one. There was a truck there yesterday with an advertisement with Terry Schiavo's picture on it, and that's a Terry Schiavo case plays a very big part in my book. That was an enormous loss. Leave aside that it was a fundamentally indecent exercise in out of control meddling, but it was also an enormous loss for the conservative movement, an enormous loss for the Republican Party, and these people are proud of it. I mean, the Republican Party should have stood up as one and condemned Joe Wilson. I'm sorry, they just should have. It was a childish. I mean, do I wish we had question time, you know, like they have in the British Parliament? Yes, I do, but we don't. Mm-hmm. And that's not the kind of stuff that. But instead, he gives this kind of half-hearted apology. And he's apologizing, by the way, for where he said the thing, not what he said. He's still maintaining that he's right and the president's wrong against all available empirical evidence. But now you're seeing him become a national figure in what is laughingly referred to as the conservative movement, and you're seeing, you know, people like Lindsey Graham and people in the National Republican Party saying, okay, well, he had sort of a bad afternoon, but we're not going to distance ourselves from him like we should.
Charles Pierce, in the address, did you see what happened at the one moment where Lindsey Graham began to applaud,
yes.
And then he looked around, he was the only Republican, and he sort of withdrew his.
Well, I think he was basically, if you see it, he sort of started to applaud. He applauded twice, I counted, and then he sort of like wiped it off. And I thought to myself, well, he's been reading the Bible, the passage about Pontius Pilate again, in terms of learning how to deal with a crowd. But yeah, I did see that. I mean, you're looking now, and this is a great untold story because a lot of people in the mainstream media insist on looking past it. The Republican Party right now is a festival for fruitcakes. It's made up of a couple of very quiet, very obscure, serious people, and a mainstream Republican Party right now that's as crazy as a loon. And as near as I can tell, there's no way out of it. Tim Pawlenty, who was considered a young moderate in 2008, is now talking about, you know, states' rights and nullification and all the stuff we thought went out with John C. Calhoun. This is just crazy now.
Well, is it what happened, for example, to Grassley? Now, and of course, the president, when he invoked Ted Kennedy towards the end of the speech, he mentioned how Kennedy worked closely with Orrin Hatch and Grassley. Grassley apparently was being cooperative in these behind the scenes meetings that the Senate Finance Committee is having on crafting this health care bill, But then when he went back to Iowa and was confronted by the lunatics at the at these town hall meetings, he suddenly then turned around and joined in the insanity by saying the Democrats wanted to pull the plug on grandma. So is it the case that even if they're reasonable human beings, these Republican lawmakers, when they get back home, they're so scared of these Limbaugh, Beck-generated jihadis that they have to go along with this garbage?
Well, let's not limit it to the Republican Party. The National Democratic Party, and particularly this administration, has been running scared of these people, too. I mean, my Lord, Kent Conrad, after this outburst with Joe Wilson, after what an overwhelming majority of the American people thought was at very best ungracious and at the very worst a nasty-tempered clown show, went back into the bill to, quote-unquote, make sure that Joe Wilson wasn't right. There's no reason for Kent Conrad to have reacted to this guy. There's no reason for the Democratic Party. There's no reason for the Democratic Party right now in the national legislature to take the Republican Party seriously. There simply isn't. They've decided they're going to be obstructionists. They've handed themselves over to their worst impulses. And this is what happened. This is how idiot America is created, is when the good people do nothing, and when the sane people do nothing, and when the people who are sensible and the people who know what's going on and the people who are willing to work don't show up.
Well, Charles Pierce, the one thing that Charlie Wilson and Ken Conrad have in common is
Joe Wilson and Ken Conrad have in common
is that they both have taken enormous amounts of money from insurance companies, HMOs, and Big Pharma.
Of course they have, and as have so many of the people who have caused problems in this. There is Republican obstructionism and there's Democratic cowardice, and I'm at a loss, quite frankly, to understand why we have either phenomenon, since I refuse to believe that the people you saw in the streets in Washington are a majority even in the Republican Party. But they're the ones driving the train.
So what's the explanation for this? Because we know that there's a disconnect in American politics between the Congress itself, which has been gerrymandered so that right-wingers and left-wingers tend to dominate on either side, and that the conventional wisdom is that Americans are mostly centrists. So is this just that the center is being silent at the moment?
Well, I'm a little bit. The word centrist these days has gotten me, gets my skin itchy a little bit. I mean, Joe Lieberman is allegedly a centrist. Ken Conrad is essentially a centrist. The mainstream position in every poll on the healthcare issue, what can only be described as the mainstream position, is a strong, robust public option. 70% of the American people want that. That's the mainstream. Anybody who doesn't is on the outside. And right now you've got a political discourse that runs from Max Baucus to the right. And that's perceived, Max Baucus is considered to be the left. That's preposterous.
Yeah, but could one interpret this as the fact that the corporatists have hijacked this debate and they're using these teabaggers as a way to kind of, just beat everybody down, and that there's a method to their madness, because the people who at the end of the day, who like the status quo, are the people with the big money.
I don't think there's any question about that, but I also think that it is time. And I think Bill Maher was very clear about this week, of all people, who said it's time for the 70% of us who aren't crazy to stand up and make our presence known. And if it's hard, it's hard. But the fact is, the 70% of the people in this country know what they want, and they have to find a way to get it. And if you've got a Congress that reacts to 30,000 crazy people in the street, how much more will they react to 70% of the population, which wants them to act a certain way?
So I guess you're talking about real democracy, government of the people.
And in a democracy, the decisions are made by people who show up.
Right.
It's not. This is one of the things. One of the things I point out in my book. This is not a system designed to run on automatic pilot.
Right.
And if you shirk your responsibilities to self-government, somebody else won't, and that person will be somebody you don't particularly like too much, who has policies you deplore.
Well, listen, I witness it firsthand here at this radio station.
If you want to talk about a story that has been utterly uncovered by the national media, it's the fact that the eighth largest economy in the world, California?
California used to be the sixth, right.
Yeah, what somewhere in there right. has become ungovernable.
Right.
California cannot govern itself right now. It's tied itself up in knots which with a bunch of programs that come straight off the cutting room floor of a radio talk show. You know, preposterous percentages to increase taxes, government by initiative. You can't govern that place anymore.
Right. Three strikes.
Fill
up the prisons.
Nobody is covering it.
Yeah.
Nobody is covering that story.
Right. But I was going to say, we experienced the notion that you just pointed out, that power devolves to those people who show up. And usually the crazies and the zealots show up, you know?
Right. Exactly, except that for some reason the crazy and the zealots are encouraged in one party and discouraged in the other.
Mm-hmm.
People are calling, you know, there are people in the Democratic Party who are referred to as crazy and zealots who are nothing more than, you know, moderate social Democrats anywhere else in the world, and yet they're genuinely crazy people in the Republican Party get elected to office.
Right.
I mean, the fact that Michelle Bachmann is in the Congress of the United States should embarrass us all. It shouldn't just embarrass the voters of the woman's congressional district. It should embarrass all of us as a self-governing republic.
Mm.
The fact that anyone's listening to Sarah Palin. For that matter, why is Newt Gingrich on my TV that much? Has anyone failed more spectacularly in a position of power, except for George Bush probably, than Newt Gingrich did in the 1990s?
No,
he's considered a sage.
Well, I was just mentioning earlier to Ron Suskin that, you know, in Sunday's New York Times, Frank Rich has got a hand-wringing piece about Obama and wasting time and allowing these people to dominate the discourse, and pointing out that the average American knows nothing about the public option, but a lot more about the death panel, which is a fiction generated by Sarah Palin. Do you accept Rich's idea that this lunacy has stolen a march on?
I don't think there's any question that the president of the United States, and I worried about this when he was running for president and actually wrote about it in Esquire, I don't think he had any idea of the nature and the form the opposition would take. I think in a lot of ways, I think he's a little bit shrewder politically than John Kerry was, but John Kerry was, as the tennis coaches say, wrong-footed. By the Swift voters, I think Barack Obama has been wrong-footed by the political opposition he faced, and that was obvious. And I mean, as much as he talked about bipartisanship, I mean, what he spoke about in the campaign was a Republican Party that frankly doesn't exist anymore.
Again, I'm speaking
with... They simply do not. He was talking about a Republican Party that existed in 1955.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Pierce, who's the author of a new book, Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. And just to broaden out your thesis in the book, Charles Pierce, Idiot America, there was a book some time back about the paranoid nature of American politics. And one of the things that's sort of consistent with Bachmann and Palin, and with also these 9/11 truthers is this idea of conspiracy, in spite of manifest logic, people really cling to these conspiracy theories. And we just had the 8th anniversary of 9/11. What is it? Is that something in the DNA of this country?
I think it's because we've had the constant kind of whoop and wharf of an elite versus a kind of democratic mass of the people, which goes back all the way to the founding. The anti-federalists at the Constitutional Convention were worried about being governed by an elite. Andrew Jackson rode to power and created the Democratic Party so this has been a kind of a dynamic. Now the farther ends of that, of course, wind up with the various conspiracy theories. So yes, I think we have been, I do think we have a sweet tooth for that stuff, and it's not altogether a bad thing because sometimes there actually are conspiracies.
Mm.
But for some reason, we don't react as well. The example I use in the book is that there are people in this country who will give you chapter and verse about the conspiracy that killed John Kennedy. And I mean, it's sophisticated. They know the white Russian, they know the names of the white Russian community in Dallas in 1963. But these are the same people who told you that Iran-Contra was too hard to understand.
Mm.
When Iran-Contra was very simple to understand, it was a lot easier to understand than Watergate was.
Well,
I think in a lot of ways, conspiracy theories become a kind of anesthetic to us and give us kind of this kind of mock political astuteness.
Hmm.
But when in reality, when confronted with the notion, for example, that your country can be lied into a war, we sort of fold up on that.
Well, just in closing,
we invest ourselves in imaginary conspiracy theories because it's easier than understanding that the real ones exist.
Well, just in closing, Giles Pearce, it is an irony that Van Jones got fired from the White House in part because he'd signed a 9/11 truth petition, and Glenn Beck was led the jihad to drive him out of there. And of course, Glenn Beck goes on every night and makes the most outrageous conspiracies about Obama planning concentration camps and all this kind of insanity. So,
you're talking about a guy who's having a nervous breakdown every night on television. I don't think he's acting. I don't think anyone's that good of an actor. I think sooner or later the guy's going to be gibbering about the transistors in his fillings before long. I mean, this is something I used to listen to on Art Bell's radio program at 2 a.m.
Well, I can't wait for that day. I thank you so much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you, Ian. It's been
Charles
a pleasure to talk to you again.
And for your new book, Idiot America, How Stupidity Became a Virtue in the Land of the Free. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Janie Coolidge, the assistant producer, Anthony Castillo, the assistant producer, and Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.